Welcome into another edition of the Dan and Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick. He's Dan, and joining us, friend of the podcast and regular here on the Dan and Victory Podcast, national recruiting analyst at Scout.com, Brian Snow. Fellas, how are you doing?
I just want to say the guest on this podcast is one heck of a lot better looking and just better at everything than the one you guys had on the last one.
Shots fired yet again.
Oh, and Coach Steele didn't even really say anything about you. I mean, really, let's be honest. There could have been a lot more Brian Snow ripping going on in that podcast than we allowed.
Well, on the record, there was no Brian Snow ripping.
True.
But this is podcast number 30. Of course, the David West edition. The world seems to be getting a big dose of David West and learning what makes him what has made him such a special player for so long in these NBA playoffs. I was kind of hoping to work some sort of like 30 donuts Aroldis Chapman thing in honor of my favorite, you know, watching that game on Sunday was painful, but finding out why Chapman stalked on Sunday was pretty much the greatest Cincinnati sports story. Maybe since Adam Dunn called the banana phone. So I got a lot of enjoyment out of that.
Can you pronounce the worst pastries that he ate? Can you pronounce that?
Absolutely not. But here's what I'm telling you is that however many Chapman ate, Broxton ate the rest. So if there were four dozen of them, Broxy put away the other two. Gentlemen, it has been since the last podcast, it has been an eventful couple of weeks, as things seem to do in the recruiting game. A lot of things have happened in a very short and compacted period of time. We now have a very good idea of what the Xavier Musketeers roster will look like for the upcoming 2013-14 season, the maiden voyage in the Big East, if you will. Three commitments in the last, 2 weeks. Edmund Sumner, 2014 guard from Detroit. Remy Abel, who's the transfer from Indiana, who will be eligible not this coming season but next season. And then, of course, Alexander Vezenkov, the Bulgarian stretch four. And, Rick, why don't we start off with Alexander Vezenkov, because he's probably the guy that we know the least about. And if nothing else on this podcast, we are deeply committed to demonstrating our ignorance.
I was so glad that you came to me first with the guy that we know the least about so I could display my ignorance, Dan. Yes. Here's the thing with Vezenkov. When Mac traveled to Greece in the middle of the season when he had a couple days off, you had a pretty good idea that there was a legit possibility they were going to get this kid. Things went quiet there for a while they were figuring some things out, but in the end, he did end up picking Xavier. And while, you know, neither Brian and I have seen this kid at all, other than, like, the three jump shots in that one YouTube video that people are making great comparisons from, what we've heard about him basically is this. He's a guy that can really shoot the ball, really pass the ball. He's legitimately skilled. He's not going to do his damage around the basket. He's a guy who's going to face up, you know, pick and pop, a catch-and-shoot type of player. What I've been told to sort of think of it as is like a Cody Ellis from St. Louis type situation. He's a guy who's going to play facing the basket and stretch the floor and really be able to do some things offensively that Xavier hasn't had at the four in a while. We've also heard that he has a knack for offensive rebounding a little bit. You know, how much of this is true and how much of it will equate to the college game, we don't necessarily know, but that's pretty much what we've heard about him so far. Snow, you got anything to add there?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, through the miracle of the interwebs, the day he committed, I was able to get a couple scouting reports, and everything was by European standards. I don't know what the hell that means, and European scouts could be buffoons for all I know. So what Rick said is what we know, and that's that. I would say, you know, I don't know if he's more Cody Ellis or Texas forward Ioannis Papapetrou, who is a Greek descent player as well. You know, obviously Papapetrou had a great year for Texas. If this kid's anything like Papapetrou, the Xavier fans will love this pickup.
Well, first of all, you mentioned Cody Ellis. So does that mean he's going to show up for a critical game with blue hair and go 0 for 15 from the field? Because I'm sure Xavier hasn't had that at the four recently.
I'm told that Xavier won't allow that.
The key is, will his coach be asked after the game if it's the worst shooting game he's had this year?
So, well, beyond that, an interesting question was brought up. And I tried to do a little research on this myself. And as it turns out, it's pretty easy to get statistics and sometimes even highlights of European players online. But it's very difficult, as Brian just noted, to get good scouting reports or anything really in English or that's comprehensible, even if you run it through a translator. But Vezenkov, as I understand, has submitted a letter of intent, a national letter of intent to Xavier. But he seemed to leave the door open in some of the interviews with Aris Thessaloniki, his current team in Greece, that this was sort of just locking him in at Xavier, but there was a chance he might still remain in Europe. What's you guys' take on that? Was that just lip service to placate the fans over there as they move into the playoffs in the Greek season? Or do you think there's a legitimate shot that Vezenkov could still back out of his commitment to Xavier?
Vezenkov told the staff weeks before the letter came that he was coming and he intended to play.
Okay.
Could he back out? Sure. What if Aris offers him 2 million euros or whatever next year? I'd back out. So it's possible, but it's what it is. I mean, the staff thinks he's coming. He's told them he's coming.
Given the state of the Greek economy, that seems that seems far-fetched. But okay,
let the record show I have no idea what a euro is worth.
So moving to Vezenkov's role on the team this year, you know, as I understand it, he's going to be playing international ball for the Bulgarian national setup all summer. So he won't be on campus until late in the fall. I mean, is it likely this guy is going to be able to – well – I mean, look, it's hard to say because none of us have ever seen him. We can't really gauge. Do you guys get the idea that the staff expects him to be a rotation guy this year or a guy that can help them, or is he more of a project?
I'll let Brian jump in here after I'm done, and he may have a different take on it. Just my gut instinct without having any information on what the staff may feel here, I would be surprised if he's a big contributor right away, mainly just because defensively and strength-wise, I think he's going to need some work. I mean, look, he hasn't played in Xavier's system, obviously. He may have never seen anything like Xavier's system and the way they want their bigs to defend ball screens. I'm not really sure what he did, what, you know, the defense was like where he played, but I'm guessing that's going to be somewhat of a steep learning curve for him coming over here. And he does need to bulk up. I mean, he's 6'7", 6'8", but he only weighs about 200 pounds from what it sounds like. So I think he'll need to add some strength as well and get used to just the physicality of the game over here in college basketball.
Yeah, 6'7", 200. Those are not dimensions that would be familiar to anyone, any of us three, I guess. But,
yeah,
but go
I'm
on,
like
Brian.
A
I'm
foot
sorry.
Shorter, but I weigh the same. So, you know, we're virtually identical. You know, I think it's going to be tough to see him. I mean, he has a chance to contribute, but being like a star or anything, I just can't see that immediately just because – quite honestly, basketball to me is probably going to be the least of his worries and the least of the growth process. I mean, I don't know much about Greek culture, but I don't imagine it's very much like being a college student in Cincinnati. So, you know, you got that whole thing. I mean, I'm sure he went to an English school. I know he speaks some English, but he probably doesn't speak the English that gets spoken on a basketball court. We all know that. That's a little bit different. So, I mean, he's got a lot of things to adjust to, and, you know, just playing the game might be the easiest part, but, you know.
Brian, I don't speak the English that's spoken on the basketball court.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm pretty sure.
So there's a lot of adjustments that need to be made, and that stuff can hold a kid back. I mean, even kids like Jeremy Hallwell, who's at Indiana right now, painfully introverted kid. Those kids take longer in college, and he had a rough freshman year. I mean – And he had everything Vezenkov doesn't have. What if Vezenkov is an introverted kid? Those kids just take longer. It's just there's too many unknowns to think, hey, big-time contributor from day one.
Well, okay, now you mentioned Indiana, so that makes a good place to segue into the transfer. You know, we've talked about at some length ever since the end of the season about guys that X might be looking at to come in, and they end up with Remy Abel, who was sort of a seventh or eighth man, is that accurate, on Indiana's team last year, Louisville native. Maybe you guys can sort of weigh in on him, because I know both of you have seen him play a great deal over the years.
Yeah, well, you mentioned he's a Louisville native, so obviously I saw him a lot coming up in high school. And he was a guy that Xavier started to recruit. He had originally committed to Bradley, and then their head coaching changed, and he had kind of started to get a little bit more buzz out on the AAU circuit and was playing really well. And I remember around the time of the Eddie Ford Hoop Fest in July, I believe, you know, teams were really looking at him, and Butler and Xavier had all shown some interest at that time before he committed to Indiana. And the one thing that he's really done well since he's gotten to Indiana, he shot the ball pretty well as a high school prospect, but he's become a pretty reliable jump shooter if left alone. I mean, he's not a guy who really forces his shot or creates his shot a ton, but he'll knock down an open jump shot and can help stretch the floor in that sense. The other thing he really brings to the team is versatility. I mean, he can play really the one through the three. He was going to probably be Yogi Ferrell's backup at the point position for Indiana this year. And the other thing, you know, that I think Xavier fans will like about him is that he'll remind you of a Sean Miller type guard, you know, a Stanley Burrell with the way he defends, or a Dante Jackson, which is sort of the mentality and the winning attitude that he brings to the table. I mean, he's been in a winning program for the last 2 years. He's learned from some great leaders and guys like Jordy Halls and Victor Oladipo. So you're bringing in a really good kid with a good work ethic into the program as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a good addition, and like, I don't think people realize, like, you know, just how good this kid can be. I mean, as a Indiana resident now, I saw a lot of the Hoosiers, and you know, whenever he was in, he did good things last year. It's just, you got to be a complete idiot to take Oladipo and Holes off the court, and then Farrell's going to play point guard because he's, you know, your real point guard. There was just no room for him to play. I mean, he ain't playing over those guys. He's not as good as the number four pick in the NBA draft coming up, you know. But I think he brings a lot to the table. He can shoot. He can defend. He's probably going to be the starting three man the moment he comes to Xavier. And I actually think he would have started at the two at Indiana this year. So I think this would be a good pickup for Xavier and someone who's really going to help them this year in practice and then on the court in a couple years.
Certainly would not be the first transfer from Indiana that would really help the Musketeers. So the third commitment, actually the first chronologically, I believe, although as Brian mentioned, I think Vezinkov was sort of in the bag some weeks ago. It just wasn't official until recently, is a guy we talked about on the last podcast, a guy we were sort of that Rick and I were sort of gushing over, Edmund Sumner from Detroit. Rick, why don't you give us a rundown of how that decision played out and your initial thoughts on the second member of the incoming class of 2014?
Yeah, well, his recruitment's been kind of interesting because he's been a guy who was kind of wanting to accelerate the process all along. I mean, it meant a lot to him when Xavier was sort of the first school to really recruit him last year. And then that continued. Xavier offered him early on, and they kept a good relationship up with him, even though he wasn't getting a ton of interest from other schools and was mostly low to mid-majors that were recruiting him as time went on. Just recently in the EYBL this spring, he's created a lot of buzz and played really well in front of some big-time coaches, and he's received a little bit more interest from schools like Michigan, Michigan State. UMass was the big competition really in the decision that it came down to, mainly because one of the former coaches of the family, his AAU program, is now an assistant at UMass. So I don't know why he was really wanting to end the process so quickly. I do think he would have continued to blow up had this gone into July. But Xavier's been on him from the get-go. They've shown him a lot of love and really sold just the idea of playing in that ball screen offense and giving him an opportunity to do his thing off the dribble. And he's a guy with a lot of upside as an offensive player. He can score from all three levels. And I've mentioned a lot on here that, you know, he almost looks like a middle schooler with the way his body looks. But, I mean, he's grown to about 6'4 now, legitimately, from what I'm hearing. He was 6'1 the first time I saw him last season, last AAU like in the spring. So he's grown about 3 inches now. He's always been a good athlete and been able to get off the floor. When his body starts filling out, I think it'll really help him on the defensive end and also finishing around the basket. But, I mean, he can already shoot it from the perimeter. He's got a lot of shake to his game with his handle. And I think he's a guy that's probably the point guard of the future for the Musketeers.
Brian, where would you know, Rick just said point guard of the future potentially. When he comes in 2014, you know, pretty good chance that Samaje Christen will have headed to the NBA. I think the conventional wisdom is he's going to be here one more year and that's it. Is that sort of where you see him fitting into Xavier's setup, is as a point guard following Samaje and potentially Brandon Randolph?
You know, I see him, and I haven't seen him play a lot. I've seen him play a very little bit, so I can't give too much on his game. But I think he'll be someone who plays as a guard. You know, what position right. did Mark Lyons play at Xavier? However the hell you want to classify it, you can classify it. He's a guard who's going to play with the ball in his hands. Now, he might be a two. He might be a one. Brandon Randolph might be a two, might be a one. But I think those two will kind of use ball screens, be interchangeable, and kind of play with the ball and you know, whoever gets it brings it up type situation.
Yeah, Dan, Brian's right about that too. I mean, you know, I said Sumner will be the point guard of the future, but I mean, really what they've got is versatile guards. I just mentioned Remy Abel could play from 1 through 3. Sumner, you know, at 6'3", 6'4", he could play either guard spot as well. But as Brian said, he's going to be a guy who has the ball in his hands regardless. The only reason I had said that about him is from what I've heard, and take this with a grain of salt because I really haven't seen Brandon Randolph play in person yet, is that Randolph's probably a little more wired to score and a little more tunnel vision with the ball, whereas Sumner is a guy who creates a lot of plays for others. So while Sumner would probably guard a two on defense where Randolph would guard a one, you know, they could reverse roles on offense or something of that nature. But that's speculation at this point.
Well, I'll tell you what, you look forward to that 2014-15 team, and it's pretty intriguing, the different types of talent they have in that class so far.
Well, one thing about that class too that I think is kind of interesting is that they're fitting a lot of different parts together. I mean, they've got, you know, some freak athletes inside, but then they've also added a guy like Vezinkov who can really shoot the ball, and they already have a James Farr who can stretch the floor. I think they've kind of, you know, they're kind of getting the type of roster build that they want together now, which they've always kind of been missing a piece or two since Mac took over. And you know, they haven't had guys who could stretch the floor, so defense is packing on them, or they don't have enough guards, or whatever the case may be. I think what you're seeing is at this 2014 time, 2014-2015 season, they should have kind of all the pieces if things pan out the way they want them to.
Well, and that's an interesting point, Rick. If you look back at Chris Mack's tenure at Xavier, with the exception of that first year when they had Jordan Crawford and, you know, they had quite a bit of talent, the last 3 years, there's really, I mean, first you had the year where Martin was ineligible and Redford got hurt right before the season, and they effectively had three guards to play the 1 through 3 spots with Holloway, Lyons, and Dante. I mean, Kevin Feeney was getting minutes exactly for that team at the guard. And then the following year, it was the issue was inside. They didn't really have anybody behind Kenny Freeze, and so you had guys like Andrew Taylor, Jeff Robinson, who wasn't really ready to be in that role at that point, and as it turns out, never really got there. And then last year, of course, I mean, I don't think anybody really needs to rehash the depth issues they had last year. So it's good to see X is, and Brian, maybe you can weigh in on this. X is really in talent accumulation mode right now, it seems like. And they're adding, and as Rick said, they're adding a lot of different puzzle pieces. And for once, Chris Mack might actually have some options with the lineups he can play and the style of play he can implement for a game rather than just making the best of what he happens to have.
Yeah, I mean, for really the first time, because even that first year, he didn't quite have the depth because you had a fat Kenny Freeze, not the Kenny Freeze that showed up as a senior. You know, he didn't have the depth that he wanted. And, you know, finally, I think this year he's going to have it. And I get calls from college coaches every day. Well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And I always tell them, get the 13 best players you can get, and then you get paid a lot of money to figure it out. I think that's kind of where Xavier is now. They finally got, you know, those good players stacked at positions, and this is why Chris Mack makes a healthy living and lives in a very nice and monstrous house, to figure out what to do with a lot of healthy, good players.
Well, and I'm kind of reminded one of Sean Miller's last teams where he was kind of when Two was a freshman, Mark was ineligible, so he had to play Dante Jackson as sort of the lead guard for a lot of that season. And basically he had five guys who were like between 6'5 and 6'8, and he just, you know, it's at some point it was just like, you know what, I'll just put all five of those guys out there. They can all shoot to a certain extent. They can all score. I don't have a go-to player. You know, we'll have C.J. Anderson bring the ball up the floor every once in a while. I guess I said they can all shoot. I was about to stop you.
Sorry. Like, Curtis, what planet are you on?
Can I do a digression here and just say that one of my favorite Xavier moments during the Sean Miller era was X was playing LaSalle, I think, at home. C.J.'s last year, I think his senior year. And it got down toward the end of the game, and the line on the game was 12.5. And X was up, I think, 11 points, and CJ threw in a three-pointer at the buzzer of the shot clock, and it was like he was handling an axe. The ball was released from, like, behind his head. It looked like Bill Cartwright shooting a free throw, if you guys remember back that far.
But didn't it, like, swish and not even touch the net, though? Wasn't it, like, straight through?
Of course, CJ turns around like he was Steve Kerr.
Right, blowing smoke from his gun.
Right. One of my favorite moments of the Sean Miller era. But all right, guys. So moving back to looking at the scholarship situation next year, X has, you know, last year X was down two scholarships because of Miles Davis and Jalen Reynolds being ineligible. You had obviously the Dez Wells situation, the Mark Lyons situation. They went in, you know, with eight eligible scholarship guys. Next year, X has got the 13 scholarships are all spoken for at this point, and 12 of them are going to be guys that can play. You've got Fillmore and Cantino in the senior class. Cantino, probably a fringe guy, but then you've got Stainbrook, Justin Martin in the junior class, Samaje, James Farr as the sophomore class, and then kind of an intriguing freshman class with Jalen Reynolds, Miles Davis, Kamal Richards, Brandon Randolph, and Alex Vezinkov. So, I mean, obviously there's going to be more talent coming in. Do you guys think – now, we had talked about potentially X trying to bring in a graduate transfer for the 2013 class. They were in on Eric Peck, transfer from Cornell, who eventually decided to go to Purdue. Xavier probably in his last two. And then Lasan Chroma, the kid from GW, just decided today to follow Carl Hobbs to UConn, where hopefully Carl Hobbs will not have any control over the number of players on the floor at any given time. So, do you guys think we'll see any more roster churn before the season starts, or do you think this is the 13 that X is going to go with?
You never rule that type of stuff out, but as of now, yeah, all 13 roster spots are spoken for. There's no one else really out there for them to go after, so if something does happen, I mean, it'd be a freak situation, as we've seen over the past couple of years, or it'd be, you know, a guy who decides he wants to leave all of a sudden. But as of now, it looks like they're good to go, and as you mentioned, Dan, you know, Remy is the only guy that's not available for this year, and you also still have Eric Stanger. So they're going to have a lot of able bodies finally.
Right, and Coach Steele specifically mentioned Eric Stanger as a guy that he thought was a critical piece last year. 2014-15 class, incoming class 2014. So far, looking at Melvin Swift and Edmund Sumner as two guys. That actually brings Xavier to the full complement of 13 scholarships. Now, we're assuming a couple things there. First of all, that Samaje Christen will stay for his junior year, which is probably a bad assumption. That everybody will stick around and that Justin Martin will be back for a fifth year of eligibility. He would be eligible after this coming year, probably to leave under the graduate transfer rule. How many spots do you realistically think X is recruiting for 2014? And are the targets still the guys we've been talking about, the Justin Bibbs, Sean O'Mara, et cetera?
Yeah, I think they're still recruiting for two spots, and those two positions that they're looking at are basically a playmaking wing, hopefully one with some size and athleticism, like a Justin Bibbs, or a center. And we're talking about true centers. You know, Sean O'Mara is a big, beefy guy. They're also in on Pascal Chukwu, Chinanu Onowaku. Lots of fun names in there. So, they're still recruiting for two spots, basically, in that class as of now.
Yeah, I mean, the staff right now is under no delusions that Samaje Christen will be a junior in a Xavier uniform. While Samaje has by no means told them, like, hey, coach, this is it. Common sense dictates this is it. And then, you figure Justin Martin's a fifth year, and then there's, Alexander Vezenkov from another continent. Who knows? You got a kid from California on the roster. A million things could happen. So you just never know. You plan for one transfer, and then the kid who you expect to be a pro will be a pro. So you got two to give. Justin Bibbs, clearly priority one on the wing spot. And then you're looking at a couple other options. Jared Nickens, kid out of New Jersey / Philly. I can't remember which one he's from. There's a couple options out there. So they're going to look into that. And then down low, Sean O'Mara from Chicago's there. I'm not quite sure he's priority one. I think Pascal Chukwu would be the guy, in a perfect world they get, one of the best shot blockers in the class. Ben Teal, a kid from Philadelphia. Chinanu Onowaku is certainly someone who's right there. I mean, there's options there, and O'Mara is certainly one of them, but I'm not sure he's the elite priority, especially if they can get Bibbs locked up, and who knows if they can. You take a swing for the fences for that final scholarship that you're after, especially because you have bodies down low with Reynolds, Vezenkov, Stainbrook, Farr, and Swift already on the roster. If you miss on one, it's not going to end your life. So you really take a swing for an elite kid, if assuming you can get Bibbs locked up.
Boy, you guys roll over those African names like it's like listening to Alex Trebek on Jeopardy, just rolling through like six languages over the course of a half an hour. Very impressive, fellas.
Dan, you do know, A, I'm the best in the business, and B, this is why they pay.
Well, unfortunately, Snow, this podcast is free, so I don't – well, it's sort of free, I guess. So.
Which, by the way, Snow tried to inform me that he was charging per podcast appearance before when I called him earlier today, and I had to let him know that we were just going to go in a different direction if that was the case.
Well, we'll just get a Brian Snow imposter to portray Brian Snow. I'm sure that's probably impossible. But
no one has my combination of intelligence and charm.
So other than people ragging on me for apparently my lightweight capacity for alcohol, which is the first time I think I've been accused of that since 2001, the Twitter was alight today, Rick, with one question. And what was that question?
Mostly everyone wants to know two things. One, who we think will start next year in the 2013-14 season. And two, what can we expect from all the newcomers?
Let me start by saying this. In my opinion, educated guess, the starting lineup on opening day is going to be very familiar to most people. It's going to be Samaje, D, Justin, Isaiah Fillmore, and Matt Stainbrook. Anybody disagree with that?
I agree.
Yeah, I think that is definitely the safest bet. Wait, who did you say at the two?
I said D. Davis.
D. Davis. The only
Samaje.
Yeah.
Samaje, Chris, and D. Davis.
The only thing I could see possibly happening there is if Miles Davis really, really has a great preseason and first couple of weeks. I think D probably wins out there, but I do think Miles gives them a little bit of a different element with the way that he plays.
So the next question is, what do we expect from the newcomers? And let's start off with Mr. Snow. Got five newcomers: Jalen Reynolds, Miles Davis, Kamal Richards, Brandon Randolph, Alex Vezenkov. Go.
I expect Davis, Miles Davis, and Brandon Randolph to probably split around 20 minutes of backcourt time between D and Samaje coming off the court, and 20 might be a high number. I think Kamal's going to maybe push for a couple minutes when J-Mart comes off the court and they decide not to go small. I think you'll see Reynolds having the biggest impact down low of the new guys. And then, you know, it's tough for me to put Vezinkov in there just simply because I've never seen him. So I don't think the new guys will have a role, but I don't think any of them are going to have a starring role. And if there is one in a starring role, Miles Davis has the best chance.
Let me add one question to that, Brian, because a guy that didn't get a whole lot of playing time last year, sort of a newcomer this year, James Farr, what do you see his role being next year?
That's up to James Farr. If he gets into the best shape of his life, I think he's got a chance to play a really good role because the cat can rebound, he can make shots, and he is humongous. Like, that is a big individual. So, you know, Matt Stainbrook can't play 35 minutes a game. You know, maybe 25, 28, 30 on a good day. I mean, that's another big human. There's no way he's going to play more than 30. So there's going to be minutes there. It's up to James Farr to do what the coaches want on the defensive end and get himself into the best shape of his life.
All right, Rick, let's go over to you. Starting five, and then how you see the newcomers plus James Farr fitting in this year.
Yeah, well, like I said, I agree with you pretty much. That's going to be Samaje, D, maybe outside chance, Miles Davis, Justin Martin, Isaiah Fillmore, and Matt Stainbrook. The biggest thing, obviously, is having Stainbrook there is going to make a huge difference. We've talked about that ad nauseum on this podcast. And then, as Snow mentioned, a lot of these newcomers probably aren't got – you know, I know everyone's excited to get them and has high expectations for them, but they're probably not game-changing type players right now as freshmen, or at least not early in the season. But what it's going to do is add depth and add guys that bring different pieces to the game. You know, Jalen Reynolds is a guy who can add a ton of energy, a shot-blocking presence on defense that they really haven't had recently. You know, just a guy who's high, high energy that can maybe get you going when you're in a little bit of a lull during the game. Now, he might also pick up 3 fouls in that minute 30 seconds, but he'll bring something off the bench as far as energy goes. I think, you know, Brandon Randolph has that same type of ability. He probably has a lot to learn. I don't know where he's going to be at defensively, and I think that's part of a concern just coming from where he comes from, where they don't play defense. But I think he's another guy who brings sort of a Mark Lyons explosiveness off the bench, and a guy who maybe can come up with some big plays and bring excitement into the game off the bench. I think Kamal Richards is a guy who's really gonna battle in practice and be a tough kid and someone who may not be ready to have a huge role on the team right now, but is going to continue to get better and work hard on this freshman season and be a great practice player. And who knows? You know, I mean, he's the type of guy who has some versatility too. He might see some minutes at the four if Xavier wants to play a little bit smaller because he does rebound, does defend, and he's a tough kid. And then I know a lot of people, you know, Brian hit on James Farr there. I know a lot of people are kind of down on him, but I agree with Brian. I mean, he could have a big role on this team. He really rebounds the ball well, as Brian mentioned. He can block shots a little bit too. The problem is he's got to get stronger down low. He's got to play with a better balance and a wider base. He was just playing too straight up a lot of the time when he got in the game last year. He was so easy to move around both on offense and on defense. And, I mean, if he's, like Brian said, if he works out hard, adds strength, and is really mobile and a little bit quicker this year, I think he's got a chance to see a decent amount of minutes. Obviously, you know, playing with Jalen is probably going to help James, too. That's going to push him because he knows there's another guy right there next to him and one of his peers ready to take his minutes. Last year, it was kind of a situation where he probably didn't have much of a chance regardless of what he did. This year, I think he's going to see that opportunity, have Jalen next to him pushing him, And, you know, like Brian said, it's going to be left up to him whether or not he gets those minutes. Then finally, Miles Davis, I think, is the closest to being ready to help this team because he's the guy with the highest IQ. He knows how to play the game. We've talked about it before. He's similar to Brad, in the, Brad Redford, that is, in the sense that he can really shoot the ball, has great range. But the difference is he knows how to play the game with the ball in his hands. If someone comes flying out at him 25 feet from the basket, he's going to up fake him and go around him and make a play in the lane. He understands what he's doing. He can make other players better. He knows how to pass, and he's a good shot maker. So I think Miles Davis is probably the one that has the chance to have the biggest role, just like Brian said.
Well, as I look at this incoming group, Brian hit on something, which was, you know, people kind of overhype newcomers, and people are very excited about this class of newcomers. And I think that the reason for that is probably that this is the first time it feels like X has had a full incoming class in a long time. And especially given the circumstances of last year with losing Jalen and losing Miles on the eve of the season with the various other departures that happened. I think there's a lot of excitement around the program, not just because of the Big East move, not just because of Samaje Christen's great year last year and because they're adding Stainbrook and there's a lot of positivity around the program, but also because they've got this new blood coming in. And for the first time in a long time, it feels like they've got a full complement on the roster and they're not going to be trying to mitigate damage during every game. It's going to, they can actually attack other teams. But as I look at these incoming guys, I mean, I have to agree with you guys. I think Miles Davis and Jalen Reynolds are the two guys that, that ought to be, you know, pretty much raring to go. I mean, I can't imagine that there's any lack of desire from those two guys having to sit out a year in NCAA purgatory, being sort of boxed out from their teammates, being boxed out from the coaching staff, not being able to be part of it. I mean, Rick, you know, you and I, where we sit, where we sat on press row last year, we could see those guys where they sat up there. And, you know, Miles was always seemed like he was pretty keyed into the games, but you could tell those guys were, it was sort of torture for those guys to sit there and watch their teammates suffer through a tough season and not be able to help them. So those are the two guys I definitely look for. Miles Davis adds that 3-point shooting threat, which is something that X did not have in the slightest bit last year. Maybe not percentage wise, but volume wise. And, you know, Jalen Reynolds is just a freak athlete, and you just can't wait to see him on the court, even if it is in just cameo roles. I think of the other guys, I think Randolph is the most intriguing just because he comes in with the hype. He's a pure scorer. He just wants to get to the basket. And I'm looking forward to seeing him on the court with Samaje Christen a little bit this coming season. Fellas, I guess one last question, and this is something, unfortunately, that's been something that we've had to deal with at Xavier recently, is where are we on the academic eligibility of the incoming class? Are there any concerns about any of these guys?
Nope.
That seems definitive. Okay, so gentlemen, I'll throw it out to you guys because we've kind of covered everything in sort of a whirlwind manner. Brian, are you hearing anything else about the Big East? Any expansion rumors or anything else at this point?
Honestly, I haven't heard a thing in months, and part of that is not hearing, and part of that's just not paying attention because I have a few other things going on. Most notably, traveling to wonderful destinations such as Fort Wayne and Pittsburgh and Kansas City. So I just haven't really paid attention to the Big East.
That's why you're the best in the business. Rick?
Oh, there's a lot of reasons why.
Yeah, I've got really nothing either to add intelligently to the Big East conversation.
There's a shocker. You with nothing intelligent to add.
Okay, so now we come to everybody's favorite part of the podcast, i.e. when everyone turns off the podcast and go listens to Adam Carolla or WTF or something like that, which is the potpourri round. And this time it's completely unplanned. We're just going to go around the circle and talk about whatever we want to talk about. And Rick has had a pretty good education in this because you may have heard him. He's now the king of all media in Cincinnati. He's doing He's doing Google Hangouts with Brad Johansson from what appeared to be Buffalo Bill's sex dungeon from Silence of the Lambs. And
did that really just happen?
That's going to stay in, right?
Yes.
And of course, guesting on Skinner on Sports on The Fan with Chad Brendel, Richard Skinner, who's never on that show, despite the fact that the show is Skinner on Sports.
It's because I keep taking a spot.
So, Rick, tell us about the radio station. Tell us about your new ventures. Where can we hear you, et cetera?
I don't know, honestly. Basically, when they've needed fill-ins, they've just called me in to help host the show. I know Skinner and Brendel very well, and they've been good to me so far, so hopefully it'll become more of a regular thing. But as of now, it's just when anyone in this city asks me to appear, I make appearances. So that's pretty much where we stand with my media schedule.
Rick Browning, media prostitute. Yeah, actually, Rick, I have to give you some props because I texted you during Skinner on Sports a couple weeks ago, I think, when you guys were talking about the NFL draft.
Yes.
And I asked you to work Kenny Irons, who we talked about on the last podcast, into a discussion, and you did so within like 90 seconds. So Benny Brazell.
Benny Brazell and Tab Perry. I also worked into a conversation.
You see, I missed that segment, so I can't verify it, but I believe you.
Hold on, Dan. We need to address something real quick. When I was on Skinner on Sports as the greatest guest in the history of Skinner on Sports, I talked about a freshman in the state of Ohio, Derek Funderburk, and I stated how I did not think he was related to Lawrence Funderburk. Mr. Browning said that's his son. As it turns out, Funderburk isn't even spelled the same way. They are of no relation. Just had to get that out there.
Rick, you want to answer that?
I mean, I've got nothing except for he was an idiot for believing me. He gave me an opportunity to call him out on the local airwaves, and I took advantage of it. They
well,
don't know.
I don't know.
It was a.
I don't know what,
it's a 2016 or 15 recruit. No one knows who he is.
16 recruit, and you guys asked me about him.
You know, he makes a good point. But let's talk about the NBA playoffs. Indiana-Miami. We've talked about the fact that the Heat are really good. And, Rick, you and I both opined on the last show that nobody could beat them.
Except, what did
I
say,
you are in.
There was one team that could give them a game.
The San Antonio Spurs. That's right.
And I still believe that.
Because they've got old man strength, and Tim Duncan is picking up cars, et cetera.
But they've also got light-skinned guys with superpowers as well. That the athleticism that they have magically found in the last couple of years has definitely helped this team out, especially on the defensive end.
Brian, I want you to weigh in because you live in the area. You go to a lot of Pacers games, I noticed, because you always inform everyone on Twitter how close to the court you're sitting. And
when you're a baller, you're a baller.
I suppose that's true. Do you think the Pacers have any chance in this series against the Miami Heat? And if so, why?
The only thing that I think they have a chance is if Dwayne Wade is not Dwayne Wade. Because this is the dirty little secret about the Miami Heat right now. If Dwayne Wade's not a top 20 player on it, they're not overly talented. They just have the best player in basketball.
Who makes them pretty much overly talented. But
you
yeah.
got a solid piece Norris Cole, a solid piece Mario Chalmers. Outside of that, you know, who are you working with? Shane Battier is 84 years old. I mean, you've got three really good players, and if you've only got two really good players, you know, you're beatable. That said, the Heat are going to win because they have LeBron James, and he is the best player on the planet by a mile.
Let's not get it twisted. The Heat don't really need to be talented other than LeBron. They need guys to knock down jump shots because playing for the Heat, you get nothing but wide open kickouts from LeBron.
He's really good at basketball.
Yeah,
like I just want to encourage people. Like I know every college basketball fan seems to hate the NBA for some unknown reason that I don't understand. But go to an NBA game when the Heat are in town or somewhere – and just sit close and see how good he is. It's truly amazing. I mean, it is incredible.
Right. Use your like Brian, use your various contacts in the basketball community to sit on the floor so you can watch really close up.
And then tweet it.
Well, actually, I will say I went up there last season for a game, and it was a really garbage game. I think they were playing the Cavs, but we did get decent seats for the game, and it is remarkable. Even the worst players at that level are just the level of play and the level of skill. It just is so much higher than college basketball, and that's not to say that I necessarily believe NBA is more fun to watch. I mean, for a long time in the 90s, I preferred women's tennis to men's tennis because there was more variety of style. There was more, you know, more things could happen on the court, whereas the men's game was in this serve and volley thing, and it was just really boring. And I think that is, to a large extent, why some people have convinced themselves that they prefer college basketball to the NBA. But yeah, I mean it is really remarkable, and you look at the Heat, and there's certainly no mystery why veteran players that can shoot are just lining up to play for that team for below market rates. Because as Rick said, boy, if you can hit a corner three, you can have a really pleasant year with Miami at this point.
I'd get 9 points in a game playing for the Heat right now, guaranteed.
Dude, you couldn't run up and down the court 3 times.
Yes, I could, exactly 3 times. I'd have 9 points, I'd pull a hammy, I'd get the hell out of there. But I would get up there 3 times for my 9 points. That was exactly where I set my limit at, was 3 times.
So you would have been almost like that walk-on that Pitino used against Wichita State that came in for about 45 seconds, traveled maybe a linear distance of 150 feet and scored 6 points.
Yeah, but I'm very efficient in my linear distance traveling. I think I probably would have kept it around 96 feet.
So moving to the Western Conference, Rick, you love the Spurs. I am an unabashed lover of the Memphis Grizzlies, just because any basketball team at this stage in the game that has two fat guys and Tony Allen is interesting to me.
Oh, Zach Randolph is so much fun to watch, too.
Yeah, I mean, he plays completely below the rim, and it's remarkable that he can get so many shots up against guys like Duncan, against guys like Blake Griffin in the last round. I mean, guys that ought to be stuffing these sort of what appear to be weak shots taken from about 8.5 feet down his throat, he just continues to do work. He's one of the most fun players in the NBA to watch play, I think.
Dan, God knows I appreciate a fat guy who can play as much as anybody, which is why you have to go with the Spurs. They have Boris Diaw.
He wins someone in the offseason. Battle.
Any fat guy battle.
Look, here's all I'm saying. We talked at the top of the show about Aroldis Chapman having like 20 donuts and then giving up back-to-back home runs. I mean, if you took like 4 dozen donuts into the Memphis Grizzlies locker room before the game, after Gasol and Randolph get done, there's nothing left, first of all, and then they go win. So, I mean, there's something to be said for that, I think.
Well, here's the thing, Dan.
Boris Diaw
literally ate someone in the offseason to get to where he's at. So you just don't know what a guy like that will do in the playoffs. You got to roll with the Spurs. Plus, Patty Mills and Tracy McGrady are like the best human victory cigars of all freaking time.
Who would have thought that Tracy McGrady at some point in his career would be a victory cigar?
Sean Miller, because we've got a funny story that needs to be told. Sean Miller is an assistant coach at NC State once, and he's recruiting Max Owens, who ended up at North Carolina. He was at Mount Zion with Tracy McGrady. This is when no one knew about Tracy McGrady. This was like on June 30th. The next week at Nike camp, well, what they did is they took Max Owens on the visit, and since they didn't know who McGrady was, they just kind of threw him in the coach's locker room and told him to hang out. Well, 1 week later at Nike camp, Tracy McGrady blows up, throws down one of the 5 sickest dunks in the history of the world, apparently. Miller looks down at his roster and says, "Holy, you've got to be kidding me. There's no way this is the guy I just hung out in the coach's office for 4 hours and completely ignored." Good work, Sean Miller, assistant coach at NC State. Had to get that out of the way.
That's why he's the best in the business, folks. The So let's talk about the Reds for a second, Brian, because you had a hot sports take on the Reds and some of the and one particular Red in particular, Shin-Soo Chu, who, you know, has been sort of my favorite guy alive over the last month or so. But you don't think the Reds should make any effort to re-sign him.
It's not logical. Here's what you got to figure. All right. Homer Bailey comes up after next season. Matt Latos in 2 years. Mike Leake, who I don't know if you guys are watching, is turning into a solid number three starter. And by the way, those make about $8 to $10 million a year. He comes up in 2 years. You still have to, you know, Johnny Cueto's on the most team friendly contract in history. That's going to end in a couple years. You've got all these guys coming up to re-sign. And by the way, Joey Votto starts making $20 million in 2016. You cannot tie up $55, $60 million of a payroll to Joey Votto, Brandon Phillips, and Shin-Soo Chu in their mid-30s. It's impossible. It's not happening. It would be dumb. It cannot happen. This is why you have a farm system. You can't re-sign everybody. Chu, sorry, buddy. Go enjoy your millions with Scott Boras on the free agent market. Reds get a first-round pick. That's the way it works.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is they're still going to be in need of a leadoff hitter. But I agree. I mean, there's nothing you can really do about Chu. He's a one-year rental. He's here to win now. And, you know, hopefully they get it done this year. Or otherwise they're going to either way, whether they get it done or not, they're going to need a leadoff hitter going forward. The one thing I don't understand, and Snow, you were part of this group. Explain to me why exactly they need to wait to sign this contract. I mean, I agree that he could probably go out and get huge dollars on the free agent market, but if the Reds were willing to pony up that type of money, why would you not sign a max contract right now when he's the best hitter in baseball?
Because this isn't the NBA and there's no such thing as a max contract.
If the Reds are willing to give him what he wants, why would you not sign that contract?
Because odds are someone's going to be willing to give him more, and that's a risk I would take. If I'm his agent, I'm saying from a business perspective, it's absolutely moronic to only negotiate with one team. It's dumb. He's a free agent. Even if he blows out a hamstring, people are going to know what he can do. They're going to say, we need this guy. He's the best hitter on the market. And if you're the best hitter on the market, you are going to get paid. And if you can leverage one team against another, you're going to get paid more.
Yeah.
This is economics.
He has a history of not being the best hitter in baseball, though. That's the issue. If by the end of the season, he's a guy who hit .263 and his OBP is closer to what it is for his career, and he doesn't have an insane amount of home runs, despite the fact that he's on pace for it right now, he doesn't necessarily get what he could get right now if the Reds are willing to offer him $15 million a year.
Well, besides that, before you even get to that.
$15 million is what he's going to get regardless. He's going to get around that number. It's right now he's the best hitter in baseball, but no one's giving him Joey Votto money because career-wise, back of the baseball card, he's not the best hitter in baseball. People aren't going to be fooled like that. I mean, look at what Jason friggin' Worth got.
Right, but yeah, you know what the market
suggests. He's better than Jason Worth all across the board.
But here's the other thing is that I think people need to realize that the market is also changing because of these mega TV deals that are coming into play now. The huge one that the San Diego Padres signed, the unbelievable one that the Los Angeles Dodgers signed. So, yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with Rick. I mean, it could be that I agree with Brian. It could be that in 7 or 8 years that people say, well, Joey Votto at $20 million a year – that's really not out of the question, assuming there's no sports bubble that's coming, which, you know, think that at some point it would come. But gentlemen, let's talk about where the Reds are. They won tonight 4-0 over the Mets, another series win. They're 6-2 on this road trip. Matt Harvey tomorrow, so probably 6-3 on the road trip. But, I mean, it seems to me, just from talking to people and being around town and working in an office with a lot of people that love the Reds, that there's a lot of like negativity around the team right now. And I look at it and I'm like, is it really just because St. Louis is off to like their best start in franchise history that people are down on the Reds right now? Because they're 10 games over .500. Their run differential is the best in the major leagues. They're pitching rotation is absolutely off the charts so far, and now they get Johnny Cueto back. I mean, why are people so dissatisfied with this team at this point? Is it just Cincinnati sports syndrome, or is there something here that is worth worrying about?
Cincinnati fans, by nature, are bred to be cynical. That's just the way it is. I mean, people look at this team like there's glaring holes, and there's definitely – part of the thing of baseball is there's always things you can second guess, and always – there's always a hole in your roster. No baseball team is perfect, especially in this day and age. I mean, you don't have teams like the Big Red Machine anymore that was much closer to you know, to being a complete team than we'll ever see here.
I mean, here's my thing. Much like college basketball coaches, sports fans love to be miserable. So I think unless they're miserable, they're not happy. So I think that's part of it. And also, as more popular as football gets, where two losses is a big deal, all of a sudden, like, people freak out when a team loses three in a row in baseball. It's going to happen. It's like they expected the Reds to be 159-3 this year or something. Folks, not happening. They're probably the best team in baseball. Their cleanup hitters had as many as official at bats as everybody on this podcast. Their ace has made 3.5 starts. I mean, what do people want? Their starting catcher goes on the DL for 2 weeks. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast. You're gonna lose baseball games, and you're gonna lose 40-60 of them, even if you're great.
Right, and I think that's I don't know if that's a – and I really think that that's one of those things where, like, the internet age, Twitter, the instant communication, it makes it easier to make every game seem like Armageddon. And you're right, Snow. I mean, football is the most popular sport in America now, and people have sort of adopted the football mindset. And the football mindset just does not work with baseball. It just doesn't. You have to accept that – yeah, if you beat the Marlins 2 out of 3 games, that's okay. Over the course of the season, I mean, if you go the course of a 6-month baseball season and you sweep 1 3-game series out of every month and go 500 in the other games, you make the playoffs. And that's hard to deal with for a lot of people because that seems like a lot of mediocre baseball with just a few spikes in the road. But that's the way teams do it. And, you know, I think the biggest – the thing that surprises me so much is the dissatisfaction with this team is understandably based somewhat on the fact that they kind of – you know, they completely dropped a turd against Philadelphia in 2010, and then last year they fell apart against the Giants. Fair enough. I wonder what people would think about the 1975 Reds if – they could be transported to today, given the fact that they had lost in 1970 to a great Baltimore team, had missed the playoffs in 1971, had lost the 1972 World Series in 7 games, had lost to an 83-win Met team in the 73 NLCS, and then missed the playoffs in 74. People would think in the ESPN age that that team was the biggest bunch of chokers imaginable. They would have been treated in the same way as those Yankee teams before they won the World Series a few years back. And it's kind of remarkable when you look at the context of those teams that are now sort of the colossus in Cincinnati. If you think about the history of those teams, I mean, really, it actually is kind of the same story that we're seeing played out with the 2010 to 2013 Reds.
Well, yeah, and Dan, you were talking about the radio stuff I've been doing. One of the shows I've been hosting from 6 to 7, basically a Reds pregame show called Cincinnati Baseball Tonight. And Joe Price, the former Reds pitcher, is always on there with us when I do that. And one of the things he's been saying is the worst thing that happened to Dusty and the Reds, as far as fan expectations goes, was them winning in 2010. Because really they were still a couple years away from being ready to do that roster-wise. They really weren't talented enough to do what they did. And they just happened to have a really good year and finished really strong. And some other teams folded a little bit, which helped them. But he's absolutely right, in my opinion, that right now we're kind of seeing that pitching staff come together. They have enough arms. they have enough, you know, some of these young position players like Todd Frazier, who's actually really slumping, and some of these other guys are ready to theoretically be big-time players. Now you're talented enough to legitimately make a run. 2010, it was more luck and a team getting hot at the right time than anything. The other thing I want to add, you know, Brian brought up the point that football has a lot to do with the way fans are reacting. You might be right. I don't know if it's football or just the internet age, and with Twitter being so popular, it offers fans a daily and instant way to react to everything, and it's become such a huge thing. I mean, Twitter has changed the way people watch and enjoy sports without question, and just the internet in general with the age of, you know, multiple niche blogs focusing on the up-to-the-minute updates for every team. People constantly are talking about their team, and with that comes fan reaction. Instead of yelling at the TV and throwing a remote at night, people are getting on Twitter and banging off, so-and-so sucks, this team sucks, yada, yada, yada. And we all know the loud minority is who we all hear more so than, you know, the majority, which are somewhat sane fans.
Somewhat sane. Somewhat.
Well, that seems like a good place to end episode 30 of the Dan and Victory podcast. As always, a pleasure having Brian Snow on, and certainly we appreciate you throwing your hat in the ring, especially on the recruiting topics that we touched on today, Brian. Really appreciate it.
It's always an honor to be on with you, Dan, and it's a misery to be on with Rick.
Oh, well. That does it for episode 30 of the Dan and Victory podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan and B. Snow, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.